Welcome to another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer. I'm Joe Patrice.
You tried so hard for that one. You even like pantomimed like something was wrong and I didn't fall for it because I'm on to you, Patrice.
This is another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer. I'm Joe Patrice from Above the Law. I'm joined by Catherine Rubino and Chris Williams. We're here to talk about the legal story, big legal stories of the week that was. But as we always do, we begin with a little bit of small talk.
Small talk.
I watched the Oscars last night.
Hey. Yeah.
Look at that. Think?
Look at you did something that wasn't law related.
Yeah, I'm proud of you.
Aw.
It reminded me, so let's talk about the accounting houses and the obligations they have to maintain the secrecy of, oh, nobody wants to have that conversation.
No one wants to have that conversation.
We did have that conversation on a past episode of this show. I don't know if anyone remembers the gaffe.
No one does. Several,
yeah. Anyway, everyone does because it was the, everyone remembers when they mistakenly announced the wrong Best Picture a few years ago. We had a guest on to talk about the obligations that the big four folks who do that job go under. Very interesting episode from the olden days. I can't even remember when that would have been. Several years ago, for sure.
I just wanted to know your response was everyone remembers and you don't even remember when it happened. That's just...
When it happened, yeah. No, I mean, I don't remember exactly what year the La La Land Moonlight situation was, but obviously those were the movies involved.
Gotcha.
Would have been pre-pandemic, I know that, because it was a time when people actually went to movies. So that was what I watched.
But yeah, how were the Oscars?
You know, good. You know, the usual pageantry nonsense. Oppenheimer rolled right on through everything to the point where they didn't even attempt to have suspense for Best Picture. Normally, they like announce the movies that have been nominated and all that, but Al Pacino just kind of like came out and opened an envelope and said, "Yeah, it's Oppenheimer." Kind of ended the suspense.
I saw a tweet, and it was like, "Oh, whoever wins at the Oscar just makes the most woke film." So apparently, Oppenheimer is woke now.
Yeah. Well, I mean the movie is kind of an indictment of nuclear weapons and so on. So yes, but
I went to my mother's St. Patrick's Day party over the weekend.
Oh, there you go.
Annual tradition in the Rubino family, which isn't actually a contradiction. My mother is Irish by heritage, Italian name by marriage. So good time was had by all. Lots of beer, none of it green. There you go.
That always weirds me out. Like, I'm like, there's no need to turn the local lake green for this. Like, there's...
It seems aggressive.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're talking about the river, but yes.
It still seems aggressive.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to dye it. It's okay.
Speaking of weird water, I'm going to head to Greece in a couple weeks now. Okay. It's so close. Because, like, one of the things you pay attention to is the water there because it's just beautiful apparently. So I'm just excited to not green wine colored apparently. I think there's a point in the Iliad where it's the water is referred to as being wine colored. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. Hopefully not because of the blood of someone's enemies, you know, but I'm looking forward to it because I think of like the philosophical aspect of you know, just seeing stuff because I'm a nerd at heart and that's my flavor of nerddom. But for literary reasons, it's also cool to be able to go to Greece and, you know, just see what the scenery was like.
Well, cool. All right, then. That concludes our small talk for the day.
There you go.
Do you have something to say?
I didn't. Do you want to just jump right into our first story?
That is what happens.
Well, usually you
ends.
Give like a little intro before you hand it over to me, but I can do that. One of our stories last week was big law related, and DLA Piper very much bucking a trend in questionable ways. They reduced the amount of parental leave that attorneys at the non-partner attorneys get at the firm. They went from 18 weeks, which is, I don't think that big law or any industry has really settled on an average, but it's certainly pretty common to get 18 weeks of leave for parental leave. And they have cut that back to 12. In their email to associates, they made sure to note that birthing parents could have an additional 6 weeks of short-term disability. But that was always true, right? The short-term disability hasn't changed. They've just reduced the amount of leave available. And certainly this quite explicitly puts the screws to adoptive parents, foster parents, non-birthing parents of every variety, which, you know, I've written stories about parental leave in big law for the last 4 or 5 years pretty consistently. And every time I've written it before last week has been increasing it, you know, increasing the number of weeks, the number of people who are eligible for it, whether it be primary, you know, parents or, you know, non-primary parents, or expanding it to include other sorts of family leave, not just, you know, new child sorts of things. And so every other story for the last 5 years have been growing these sorts of things, making it more attractive to be a parent and a big law associate, which has, you know, dovetailed, I think, pretty nicely with the whole, we need to care a lot about work-life balance and making sure that, you know, attorneys aren't getting burnt out working in big law. And this is very much the exact opposite, which is I've talked to everybody internally at ATL, and, you know, ATL has been tracking what firms' parental leave has been since at least 2008. And no one can remember a firm
going backwards. Yeah, it is weird because this is one of those perks that's just so easy, right? Like it's so easy to get the gold, you know, the little gold star as the good guys by offering family leave. It's also something that, you know, people don't take all the time. So right. It's not like you're opening the door to suffering.
It's not every associate every year.
Yeah, you're not suffering huge productivity hits all the time like you would if you expanded your vacation time or anything like that. It just is, it's a wildly unforced error, it would seem. And I did hear some musing that this is the sort of thing that sometimes this person suggested, maybe that what's going on is this is an even
way to
more
force people out the door?
An even more stealthy than stealth layoff situation. A sort of situation where they know they need to trim ranks a little bit, and maybe this is the sort of thing that gets some people to voluntarily leave without them having to start firing people. I don't know.
I don't know.
That's a wild take.
Yeah. I also think that this is probably worse than just doing, whether it be stealth or admitted layoffs, because I think that there are firms that are doing that right now. I think when they're limited, I don't think that this is necessarily changing the reputation of firms that are making those cuts, but this will always stay with the firm, I think. Whether it's good times or bad, I think that changing your parental leave shows it shows your hand. This is what you think. You don't value families. You don't value anything but the amount of hours I can bill for you. And this shows it. This lays the truth on the table, and I think in a really harsh way. I can't imagine that actual people thought this was a good idea. Like, you know, the amount of people who must have been involved in signing off on this, and they went through with it. They still went through with it, which to me, I don't know. There's not a lot. I think that when you're joining the industry and there's a lot of big law firms, you got lots of offers, you have lots of interviews, it's hard to make distinctions between firms when you don't really know a lot about them. This is a real easy way.
Yeah.
Even if you're, and this is the sort of thing that, you know, you don't have to be currently expecting a child or having short-term plans to expand your family in any way for this to sting. I think this leaves a mark on the firm.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a move that is, it puts it out of step.
Yes.
With everyone else. And that's the other thing. Like, we have firms that do, you know, not too great things that hurt their reputation, but they usually have some cover, as in there's someone else who's doing the same.
Which I think is the distinction between what you're saying. Is this a cover for sort of layoffs? There's enough firms doing layoffs that it wouldn't be just DLA that's doing this. This problem is just DLA.
Yeah.
It's a them story. It's not an industry-wide story. Layoffs are an industry-wide story. There's a big difference between that. And I don't think you get to shake this.
And the way in which this is just something that no one's done in at least our memory.
Since at least 2008, yeah, I'm pretty confident. I, you know, what happened before then, who's to say? Was there even an internet? But certainly since 2008, I can say with a fair amount of certainty that no Am Law top 200 law firm has done this.
Yeah, really, really unfortunate move on their part. And yeah, I think it'll impact them going forward. Yeah. McDermott Will & Emery is Vault's number one law firm for associate satisfaction 3 years running. Why? Because they're doing big law better. At McDermott, you define what your success looks like. They help you achieve it. McDermott's award-winning professional development program and hands-on mentorship propel you toward your goals, while the industry-leading wellness benefits help you feel your best so you can do your best. Want to see how your life could be better at McDermott? Head to mwe.com/abovethelaw. Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Callidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Callidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Callidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CallidusAI.com. That's CallidusAI.com. Okay, what else is going on? Are you familiar with metadata?
I am.
You know who isn't?
The Supreme Court?
Apparently the Supreme Court. So when you have documents, obviously, if you've practiced law for any period of time, you're aware that you need to, you know, scrub that sort of data before you turn things over to the world. You make sure to, you know, save it as a PDF that can't be edited, all those little moves that you're supposed to do. The Supreme Court apparently...
Or not do if you're doing discovery. You're not supposed to eliminate metadata in those instances.
But apparently the Supreme Court did not get this memo in its decision on the Colorado ballot case involving Trump. We got a quote-unquote unanimous opinion, of course, in that 9 justices all agreed that Colorado can't unilaterally kick Trump off the ballot. What that hid was the fact that it seemed as though there were a 5-4 break in whether or not they thought that the reasoning was correct, with Justice Barrett writing something kind of on the side saying, I don't know as though I agree, but can't we all just get along? Which, you know, whatever. And then the 3 liberal justices writing a opinion that was a concurrence, but seemed a little pointed in its criticism of the way in which the majority went very deep. The majority does not just say, hey, patchwork election laws are, you know, a problem, and therefore there's no way that the framers of the Insurrection Clause assume this to apply, be applicable by states to presidents. Instead, the majority went into a long, unneeded, completely unnecessary side trip about what conditions somebody could get somebody kicked off for and how many votes it would take to do XYZ, all things that the concurrence said were above and beyond the question at hand, which was biting criticism. And it was criticism that, it seems, based on the metadata, was originally supposed to be a dissent. And then the dissenting, concurring in part and dissenting in part, got edited at some point into just concurring.
And how did you even figure that out?
Because it's in the metadata.
Right. But, right. Well, didn't Mark Joseph Stern go through and if you highlight it, it actually comes up as, you know, you can see what was previously there. Right. And literally the part that says concurring used to say concurring in part, dissenting in part.
Correct. So Mark Joseph Stern identified this in another computer person who, one of his followers on social media, replied by digging even deeper and found it all within the PDF
the
data if you went into it. But yeah, no, it's... obviously, it's embarrassment that the court, who makes decisions about how technology functions in our lives every day, can't handle basic word processing. Not great.
Yeah.
But also, there was a lot of back and forth afterwards about whether or not the liberal justices were bad people for concurring and for agreeing to concur as opposed to dissent, with a lot of the more liberal critics calling them cowardly for not standing up to this, whatever. I don't know. But what do other people feel about that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was pretty clear that what they were going to do in terms of, you know, trying to create some sort of distinction between their reasoning and sort of the majority. And I think that in the oral arguments, it seemed that they were going to latch on to this sort of patchwork justification. The thing that really struck me is that, you know, we hammer the Supreme Court justices that are older and refusing to retire all the time. And I think that is very, very fair and very, very valid. But currently you have four justices on the Supreme Court in their 50s. These people should know.
Yeah.
Right? These are not people who, you know, we're halfway through their career when computers and technology became a thing. These are people who were in the start or in the prime of their career when these things became very obvious. And it is shocking to me that someone in their early 50s doesn't know better.
Yeah, no, it's bad. Now, like, I'm much more of a person. I actually think that the dissent is cool. The consent or no dis. Discernence, whatever we're
discernence,
calling it.
I like that.
I feel like, yeah, I mean, I it could also be a consent, but that's another word that justices don't know.
Oh,
so anyway, okay. I think that actually got it right. I, unlike some of the critics, you think that they should have allowed Colorado to make its unilateral decision. I don't think that actually is for the best. I think that the problem in this country with elections, by and large, is that we allow states far too much power to control federal elections with patchwork and different laws, usually implemented for the purposes of suppressing the vote in one way or the other. So I think that the liberal justices were correct that it's that's bad. I think why
it opens the door.
And I think why I think there's a good faith argument that the reason they wanted to recast it as a concurrence rather than a dissent is that they felt they were laying the groundwork with their opinion, one that didn't run afield of the patchwork problem, that they were laying the groundwork for future cases that could cite this concurrence as, you know, reasons to strike down onerous state laws. And so I don't know. I thought that their decision seemed sound to me, and it seems like the reason for the decision was to lay some, you know, set the stage for future cases.
I mean, I think I understand some of the agitation that other people have about it, because it does seem like liberals are constantly making good faith efforts, which are then, you know, not reciprocated. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there's certainly a natural frustration that why are we doing that when we have an opportunity to get him off the ballot? Let's do it while we can. He's the one saying that he'll be a dictator, although only for day one. So don't worry too much about it. It's still terrifying, right?
I think it's a sad day for jurisprudence when there was an opportunity for a dissent to be written by even just one judge and they choose not to. Just because, like, for people that are, like, nerds about the law or, like, want to know how, like, thinking changes over periods of time, there have been some really strong dissents that have been, even if they weren't controlling, they've been interesting. And, like, they've laid the groundwork for future decisions. Like, they're like, what's it? There was a, what was that? Was that recent? Sackett. I think it was Sackett. The one that overturned the Nexus protections for water, right?
Yeah.
That decision, the way it played out, felt like take Scalia had a couple decades ago, right? So it's just interesting to, like, see how ideas went out over time. And who knows, the dissent could have been something interesting.
The reasoning of the sort of left of the court is still documented in the concurrence, though, right? Like, as we said at the top, it was pretty biting for a concurrence.
True. But the question earlier was, like, what are your thoughts generally on the dissent not being written? So that's my thought. Like, I like when there's, like, a robust, fleshed out, we disagree, and it's posed as such rather than, like, wishy-washy, you know, like, take the strong take.
That is an interesting question, and probably one that speaks to the philosophical differences of the court these days. Like, we do have a majority who feels comfortable grabbing lone descents from the 80s and running with them. But for most of our history, the way in which justices would treat a dissent would be to say that that was the opinion that was wrong, whereas a concurrence would theoretically have more, would offer you more ability to say that you were not, you know, breaking with precedent when you start implementing the ideas in that concurrence. But, you know, that might be just be a difference of the way in which the two philosophies operate at this point.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up. There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
Okay, the State of the Union was last week, which, you know, usually is a laundry list of policy proposals, the many of which aren't necessarily legal. We every year have our above the law annual drinking game for it, which you don't have to drink alcohol for. You can do whatever you want for it. But, you know, the rules were designed around the idea of booze, but whatever. Anyway, we had our drinking game.
How do you feel about that?
What do you mean?
The teetotaler backlash against the calling it a drinking game.
Yeah. So last year we had a bit of teetotaler backlash against it. It is an important point that the legal profession has substance abuse problems, and therefore it's something that we should not take lightly. Obviously, we have, you know, occasional columnist at Above the Law, Brian Cuban, talks about these issues directly. And that's important. That said, I also don't think that recognizing that abuse can happen is mutually exclusive with recognizing that most people are capable of engaging with alcohol without crossing over that line. And so I think that it is, you know, it's something of a disservice to just pretend that it doesn't exist. So it goes a little bit of both ways. We went ahead and did it again, obviously, though this time with the caveat that you don't have to, and yes. Don't have to drink.
I will say, with that in mind, you did go the extra route of ramping up things that could be abused with the Panera lemonade mention.
I did suggest that that you could do the Panera lemonade, but I mean that's too dangerous, probably. So maybe you scale it back.
That's the point where I was like, yeah, this is the America liberals want. Like, yeah. Cocaine is one thing, but come on.
So anyway, the speech did touch on legal issues fairly early. Several of the justices showed up, including some justices who aren't even justices, as Anthony Kennedy decided to crash the event. As I put it, much like George Santos, somebody who nobody wanted there decided to show up anyway. But the speech took a constitutional turn early in conversations about IVF and abortion, because obviously the post-Dobbs fallout has been, despite the Supreme Court writing in Dobbs, oh, well, this will just be an issue for the states and everything will be fine. We have now had a situation where the state legislature in Alabama seems intent on defending IVF, and the Alabama Supreme Court seems convinced that the Constitution will not allow that. And that's a clash that's going on that seems to be a direct result of Dobbs. Biden decided to point that out and challenged the Supreme Court in a fairly direct and I don't think necessarily precedented move, calling them out right in front of them, and quoted from Dobbs that a line about how women are not without political power, which was a kind of sneering aside that Alito put in there to say, well, if you women actually want to have these rights, I guess you could probably uniformly vote us out, but by us, not the Supreme Court, obviously, because they're a monarchy.
They're not accountable.
Yeah, they're not accountable for anything but vote out the Republican Party, knowing that that probably isn't something that could be done, but we'll see. Biden quoted this line directly as something that the Supreme Court's going to find out how true it is, which, fine. This was taken very much as a kind of direct threat toward the Supreme Court. It is
the kids call it a fuck you.
Yeah, yeah. Which it kind of is telling to how disingenuous the original Dobbs opinion is. I think if when you quote it directly and positively, it is seen as a threat, right? Like you wrote this and we agree with it. If you say that to somebody, normally it is not taken as a dig. The fact that it is pretty indicative of the fundamentally dishonest nature of the opinion. But
that cracks me up. There was some point, I think it was NPR. They just decided to tweet line by line the Constitution. And then a whole bunch of MAGA people were mad and angry and like, you know, this is the woke liberal media. And
it's yes, like, I do remember
these
that.
We hold these truths to be self-evident. Like, what do you mean truth? You know, it's like...
Oh, was it the Declaration of Independence?
I think it was the Declaration. Yeah, because there was a line about like basically like F you to tyrants, I think, in it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And they were like,
it must have been
four more years. Like, bro, like, what kind of American are you that you don't recognize what they're quoting from?
It must have been that because the Constitution, you always forget, is really dry and boring in some of those places early on. Yeah. Like, the number shall be divided by the blah, blah, yeah, number, the total number of population by blah, yeah. blah, yeah. yeah. So, yeah, so it's probably, but
yeah.
Declaration, but wow.
The State of the Union, the part that really pissed me off was the part where Biden is like, nobody should be in jail for having weed. And then Kamala's goofy ass stands up and gives like a strong round of applause. I'm like, weren't you the top cop that were arresting people for smoking? I'm like, yeah. What happened? You know, I wish
it's become politically expedient to be the other way now. So here we are.
And that's one of the things that frustrates me about the pervasiveness of blue no matter who or, you know, lesser evil rhetoric. It's like it's just a great way to efface accountability. I wish we were at a point where we could be like, wait, is that your man's in the back? You know, like.
Well, what's the line that Ellie Mistal used to quote this all the time, and I can't remember what it is, but it's from some like West Wing episode, and it's vaguely paraphrasing because I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's something like, let's not dwell on the fact that you're late to this party and let's just celebrate that you showed up at all. And so that's how you have to deal with that kind of a response to those questions. All right. So thanks everybody for listening. You should subscribe to the show, get new episodes when they come out. You should give reviews, write something, give stars. That all helps. You should be following us on social media. I'm at Joseph Patrice, Chris is at Rights for Rent, Catherine's at Catherine 1, the numeral 1. We're over at Blue Sky 2. I'm Joe Patrice over there. The blog is at ATL blog. You should also just be reading AboveTheLaw.com every week so that you see these and other stories before they come out. You can check out other podcasts. Catherine's the host of The Jabot. I'm a guest on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. There are several other programs from the Legal Talk Network that you should be listening to. And all of that said, we'll check in with you again next week.
Peace.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.